The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Connect with ultra-fast speeds and our best ever Wi-Fi all around your home.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so to this week, comedian and best-selling author Adam Kay talked to me about leaving behind his life as a junior doctor and how his latest book takes kids on a gruesome guide of human anatomy. 3 years ago, we received a letter that contained a message of gratitude and hope in the midst of heartbreaking loss. Mary Noonan was the author of that letter, and she spoke to me about her daughter, Emer. Actor, broadcaster and writer Stephen Fry told me about Troy, the final installment in his best-selling trilogy of books that retells the Greek classics. And historian Donal Fallon treated me to the Irish origins of Halloween and the global impact of Bram Stoker's Dracula. So that's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy. Adam Kay, good morning to you.
Good morning.
It's nice to talk to you. The Kay's Anatomy, a complete and completely disgusting guide to the human body by Adam Kay. I'm already intrigued, and I think children will be. Why did you think it was time for younger people to learn about how grotesque and real it all is?
Well, I've always been fascinated by the human body and the amazing way it works and the various ways it goes wrong. And I've always been slightly confused by the way that it's never been like a cool topic for kids in the way that like space or dinosaurs get their imagination. And I wonder if it's because it's something we're forced to learn sitting on an uncomfortable chair and being, you know, bullied into hearing about it in the classroom. And I just wanted to share the, you know, the funny, the disgusting, the repulsive, but also sneaking in there all the stuff they actually need to know about the body. And I suspect now more than ever, kids have a lot of questions about health, and perhaps their parents can't always answer them.
Well, I don't know what it's like in the UK. I know you have the stiff upper lip and we have Catholic guilt. So between us, we have a really strange relationship with the human body. So and I'm hoping that this next generation that you're writing for are just have fewer hang-ups so they can just talk about it, because this is who we are, this is what we have, and this is how it works.
Absolutely right. That's really important. And as well as going through all the sort of the disgusting and the wee and the poo and the vomit and everything they want to read about, there's lots of important stuff in there, including like taking a look at our mental well-being, and talking about things like anxiety and depression, which a lot of kids will experience growing up, sadly, and things like diabetes and body image and smoking and alcohol. You know, it's all done with a lightness of touch, but it's nothing that they don't need to know about, and it probably avoids an awkward conversation with their parents.
And it debunks a few things. So, for example, Valentine's Day is a complete fake news event, given the nature of what a heart actually looks like.
Yeah, no, they definitely need to sack whoever designed the heart emoji, because it's a lot more sort of grotesque than that. But it's been going on for thousands of years, the idea that the heart is the part of the body that's anything to do with emotions. Obviously, we now know it's the brain, but like the ancient Egyptians, if you were going to get mummified, if you're important enough for that, they thought the brain was of so little importance that they would scoop it out and bin it, whereas there was like holding the skull together or something, whereas the other organs got put in nice jars around your pyramid.
Yeah, and the brain feels no pain. It's lyrical.
Yeah, the brain feels no pain. It's basically a poetry book, I guess, isn't it? Even though it's obviously in charge of feeling pain and being aware of that sort of thing, if you do an operation on someone's brain, you don't need to actually anaesthetise that area. And in fact, doctors do certain operations on people and they want to, on their brain, check that it hasn't knocked off a bit of the brain, does something useful, so the patient can be totally awake while they're having a good old rummage in there. In fact, I describe a case of a woman who was a violinist who was playing the violin during her operation to make sure that it wasn't affecting things. Hopefully she wasn't terrible at it, otherwise that'd been really distracting.
And I do want to ask you, before we veer into other areas, about the invisible cloud that surrounds us.
Yes. So your skin isn't actually the outermost part of your body. Beyond that, you've got what I refer to as a sort of farty skin cloud, sort of full of sort of bits of skin that have flaked off and various molecules coming from all the various holes in our bodies. So yeah, next time you're hugging someone, you're not hugging their skin, you're hugging their farty skin cloud.
It's just such a lovely, reassuring thing to know that the body is a marvel, isn't it? I mean, when you think of it, anytime I see a newborn baby or whatever, everyone always says, look at their nails and their fingers. Like, it's just the magic of it.
Oh, it's absolutely extraordinary. It sort of almost defies belief, the complexity of it. So, like, coming back to the brain, whatever the Egyptians thought of it, it's made up of 100 trillion different connections. Wow. And 100 trillion is this, you know, that's the number of stars in 1,000 galaxies. If you had £100 trillion, you could buy every single house on the planet. If the part of your brain that looked after memory alone was on a computer, it would have 2 million gigabytes of storage. It's it's a clever bit of kit, and
You talk about the lungs puff so much air. I mean, it's the analogies you draw that allows us to kind of make it's relatable, accessible.
I think it's pointless when you're writing for kids, or in fact when you're writing for anyone, just using a billion, a trillion, a thousand, a million, because it's all slightly arbitrary. So, like, if we're talking about the heart pumping 7,000 litres of blood a day, it's better to talk about that being enough to fill 90 bars, or fairly disgusting bars, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. The age group that you're aiming at here, Adam, is what, roughly?
The age group is either 7 to 12-year-olds, or their parents who never really learnt biology properly.
Yeah,
in the first place.
That's exactly what I was. I would echo that entirely. Kind of go, this book is for you, but I'm not giving it to you just yet because I haven't finished it yet. It's one of those, isn't it? When you got into the medical world, and you know, you talk about how some people read this is going to hurt, and they said the parents said that my kids read your book and now they don't want to do medicine. You tell me about your response to that class of attitude.
Yes, my response to that, which is a question I've had quite a comment I've had quite a few times.
Yeah.
If kids read the book and they don't want to do medicine anymore, then good, because if that book's going to put you off medicine, then medicine is really going to put you off medicine. Yeah. I think it's a job that you have to go into with your eyes wide open, and that's certainly not always the case. That wasn't the case for me. I didn't really realise the psychological toll that the job takes on people, and hopefully this is a book that tells people a little about that.
Yeah, and you know, when you reflect, I think that the world, I know in this country for sure, and the world overall since COVID, has become more conscious of the work and the value of people working in the medical side of things. Would you say there's a greater understanding of that stress now, Adam?
I think there is. I think you sometimes struggle to humanise the people who are working in the hospitals and the surgeries and things like that. I did this clinic. I worked in obstetrics, and I did an antenatal clinic every single week, which always overran by about 3 hours. And every single week, someone would, you know, rightfully complain that I've been waiting here for 2 hours, and my car's run off the meter and all that. Not once in the years of doing that clinic did a single patient say, oh, you probably don't want to be here either. You don't think of your doctor as being particularly human, but I think that has changed. I think that's a good point you make, because, you know, we're seeing people literally putting their lives, you know, on the line, coming home with pressure sores on their faces from, you know, wearing protective equipment all day. We're seeing the toll it takes. And hopefully, if any of us ever took the healthcare system for granted, that will hopefully be a thing of the past.
And you quit the NHS, National Health Service, in 2010.
That's right.
And do you look wistfully at the newspapers or at the news now in the middle of the pandemic and think, I wouldn't mind being kind of playing a part?
Yeah, I mean, I left because I had a terrible experience on labour ward. You know, your bad days at work were extremely bad in a sort of life and death environment, and I realised I wasn't actually particularly cut out for it. And I have always missed it. I've missed the feeling of helping people, of being useful, and that's been magnified a huge amount. And they did a shout out for any full doctors to come back. And I put my hat in the ring. It turns out they didn't want an obstetrician who's not worked for a decade to be manning their intensive care units. And in fact, that drove me to publish a book called Dear NHS, which was a collection of 100 celebrities writing about their experiences of the healthcare system here, and to raise money for charity. It made £250,000 for medical charities here. So I assuaged my guilt slightly by doing that.
It's all part of the effort. Congratulations. And you got big names. You had Ed Sheeran and Paul McCartney and Michael Palin and Julie Walters and all sorts of luminaries from the world. But I think within that book of anecdotes, you were kind of taken aback by how you might have expected something mildly amusing from a comedian like Jimmy Carr, but suddenly, or indeed Graham Norton, but suddenly they've used the opportunity to go somewhere completely different.
Yeah, I mean, I gave people an absolute blank check for what to do if they wanted to write something. I didn't steer them one way or the other. And yeah, Jimmy Carr, I find hilarious. I thought that was going to be, he would do a standard Jimmy Carr monologue, but he talked extremely powerfully, hugely movingly about the death of his mother and how we deal with death and how we talk about death and how important it is to, to recognise it as a part of life, and that sort of that blew me away. And similarly, Graham Norton, he writes obviously beautifully whatever he does, and he tells a story right at the start of the book of having just moved to London as a drama student, and essentially he was coming back home from a night out and got stabbed, and essentially came extremely close to losing his life. He, there's a moment where he says to one of the nurses looking after him, "I'm going to live right," and they just pause rather than answering. He said at that moment his flesh hugged his bones, and that was, I found that surprising, because Graham Norton's just sort of been such a fixture in my television watching life for decades, but you sort of expect that you know everything, and you don't expect to find out a huge secret. But he described the health service as being this sort of parachute that swept him up, and sort of in loco parentis. He'd left his family behind, and the doctors and nurses were there to sort him out when they weren't.
I'm always amazed, Adam, with the British relationship with their National Health Service. It's one of, it's awe, if that's not too big a word, but certainly respect, to give it probably a more accurate description, in a way that you don't see too many countries or nations with that level of respect for a health service. What is that?
I think it comes down to the way it was set up 70 years ago, and that it's free at the point of service based on nothing other than your need for healthcare, definitely not based on your bank balance or your title or anything like that. And, I guess at the far extreme of that system is in the United States, where I've been unfortunate enough to be ill when I've been out in the States working before, and it is literally a case of swipe your Visa card, and then we'll try and stop you bleeding.
Wow, yeah, what a difference! So that would make sense as to why people would feel that way. You've got two siblings, is that right? Working as doctors also.
I do, yeah. And black sheep of the family,
yeah, obviously. But I'm just curious to know how you feel about where we are in terms of when we saw the pandemic in the first 3 to 5 months, there was this, particularly in the UK, the stand up and a clap for the frontliners, and you had these kind of slightly awkward but well-intended displays of people standing outside buildings or what have you, and then it started to kind of peter out a little bit. And my question and my point I'm trying to make is that it feels as pandemic fatigue sets in, I just feel there's a bit of slippage in how much we should back up our frontline people.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that there is a danger of that, and it's not. There's fatigue in terms of all sorts of things,
yeah.
including, and probably most importantly, how much we're listening to the messages that we're being told by the, you know, by the public health experts about what we should be doing. But sadly, it is a bit of a long haul. I mean, to be honest, I think over here, the doctors and nurses and who are my friends and family, it's all very well getting a nice round of applause, but I think more importantly is that the NHS gets properly funded, that they can go to work and they've got adequate protective equipment to wear, that they're not having to work double and triple shifts, to keep the rest of us on the road. So I think that's the truly important thing.
For sure. Anya in Selbridge has been on to text to say Adam Kay's book is brilliant. It's informative. It's real information, but told in a humorous way. It's an education in physical and emotional facts. Great read for all, including nanas like me. I'm off to check out why I need my daily tablets. Another from Moira says, I loved This Is Going to Hurt. I'm not a big reader, but my son suggested it. And I couldn't put it down. I'm a nurse, and it resonated with a lot of the humour. A lot of the humour resonated, which is so important. So thank you for that. I mean, Adam, obviously, humour is your bread and butter now, and there's great humour in the darkest corners, and I think that's something that people find much more relatable than you realise. In other words, people can stomach dark humour more than they get credit for.
I think so. And these were diaries that I wrote at the time that I was working as a doctor. And they don't teach you how to cope at medical schools, either where I live or where you live, where I've done a lot of speaking. Mm. And you have to develop your own coping mechanisms. And for a lot of doctors, it's things like alcohol and even recreational substances that we don't talk about very much. A lot of people don't cope. There's a huge amount of mental illness amongst doctors. But for me, my attempted coping mechanism was looking for the light amongst the dark and writing down the funny and the silly and the disgusting. And, you know, that was what kept me going. And, it's in very clear relief, the funny stuff against the very sad stuff.
For sure. Mary was on to say this is going to hurt, it's hilarious, but also it describes the conditions of the NHS and how it works, and I would think a great comparison with the HSE here in Ireland. Fatigued health workers trying to do the best they can. And on a slightly more humorous note, another one says, I remember when my sister found out she had a skeleton inside her, she was terrified of herself for weeks. Maybe sometimes it's better not to know too much. I think the kids are going to love being freaked out. Kids have quite a ghoulish sense of humour anyway, as you probably know at this stage, Adam. And can I ask you, do you know at this point what they're getting the greatest kick out of from your complete and completely disgusting guide to the human body?
I'm afraid that the kids have been thoroughly predictable, and messages they get from their parents on social media are all about the poo and the wee and the vomit.
Straight
and
to the toilet. Straight.
Not. Yeah. But what can you do?
What can you do? You knew that was going to happen. Listen, I know you were due over here to do a talk, to do an appearance at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre. That's postponed. So we'll see you when we see you. How about that?
Yeah, hopefully that's happening next year.
Oh, good luck with it all. And thanks for your time, Adam. Congratulations on the new book.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you kindly. That's Adam Kay. As I say, you know him from This Is Going to Hurt, but this is his new book for kids and for man-children like myself. Kay's Anatomy, a complete and completely disgusting guide to the human body, is out now. 9:20, nearly 9:26 now, this Wednesday morning. About 3 years ago, we got a letter into the programme that knocked us hit us for six, because it captured the sort of, in many ways, the community spirit that we're talking about today, about lighting the lights in Loughrea and Uachtaráin and around the place, and people coming out with their sparklers in the front garden, just that lovely sense of people, Irish people, at their very, very best. And I wanted to catch up with Mary Noonan and see how she is. She joins us now. Good morning to you, Mary. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning, Ryan.
Well, I'm going to ask you to bring us back a few steps, if you don't mind. You're from what part of the world?
I'm from County Clare, and as I'm speaking to you here, I'm looking out an absolutely beautiful vista on Loughrea in East Clare, fabulous part of County Clare, a hidden gem, I would say, in the geography of the countryside. A lovely place.
And oh, gosh, you must have beautiful colours and nature at this time of year there.
Oh, my God, it's wonderful. Yeah, the trees and the autumn colours are stunning, to be honest. Yeah, really fabulous.
And the people you would have taught down through the years as a principal of what school?
I was the principal of Drumandoura National School in Killinina, here in the... I'm about 5 miles, 5 or 6 miles from where I live.
Yeah.
And I was the principal there for... Well, I taught there for 30 years. I was the principal for 29, so that's a long time.
Yeah, congratulations on your retirement.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah,
thank
long deserved, and I hope you're enjoying it so far.
Yeah, I am actually now. I much more even than I thought I would initially, but it was an unusual year to retire, of course, with all that happened.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, and you know, you'd miss the kids and my great staff, and I'm going to say a shout out to my colleague who's also going to retire in the coming year, Mrs. Colleran, a wonderful colleague that's worked with me, and all the staff and the parents and children, wonderful people.
Yeah, good on you, man, and we wish her well too. I'm going to talk about your children, Declan and Michael and Cathal and Emer.
Yes.
And if we go back to Emer's joie de vivre, and I say that emphatically using the French expression, because you were Francophiles, the pair of you.
We are and were, yeah, absolutely. From an early age, I suppose, both of us were, well, I was very interested in French, and when the children were young, we went to France, and Emer and I in particular went, you know, even on our own and with friends. And she was smitten by France from a very early age. She loved the French and she loved the way of life and she loved the idea that they took 3 hours to have their lunch. Well, that would suit her now. And, you know, yeah, and when she did her leaving cert and was due to go to study music at the College of Music in Cork in UCC, just literally not a very short time beforehand, she decided... she thought, I think, that by studying music full-time, even though she had done every grade possible in the two instruments that she played, that she might lose her love of music. And, yeah, so she decided to study French and Irish in UCC.
Which was very talented. I mean, obviously, she was... What instruments? Was violin?
Yeah, the piano initially and then the violin. But she really... She started the violin with a good friend of ours, Sister Mary Brosnan in Gort, and until she was maybe, well, right up along, and she joined an orchestra called Cool Music Orchestra that are based in South Galway, but have people coming from all over. There's an incredibly talented lady there, Katharina Baker, she's a German lady, who started up a school of classical music in a small town in the west of Ireland, in Gort, and it's just gone from strength to strength. There's probably 200 people in it now. It's amazing.
Amazing. So with that lovely combination of French and music, and as an interest in a lust for life, I suppose, brings us to Emer turning 21 in April 2017. And graduating from UCC in October, and then France.
Yes, yeah, she had it in her mind all the time, really, to go to France. Now, she didn't take the gap year, as many, you know, the year that many of them do, the Erasmus year. So I think she decided when she'd be earning a few bob, you know, to come off mum's payroll for a while. So she applied for this position under the program, with a bilateral program with between the Department of Education here and the French Department of Education, called Enseignant Étranger, and she was accepted for that, and she was placed in the school in a town called Annonay, which is down about 30 miles south of Lyon, in the Rhône-Alpes, beautiful area actually, and she thought she actually got word that she had been chosen to go on her 21st birthday on the 28th of April 2017.
So she was on the move. Now, I mentioned your children, and there is one daughter, Emer.
Yeah.
So,
three boys, actually. Declan and Michael are her older brothers, two very tall men, and then Cathal, who is just barely a year younger than her.
So I presume Dad would have had kind of trouble saying goodbye at the airport there on this occasion.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. He absolutely adored her, yeah. And the boys, you know, she was just great fun. She was the best crack ever. She was a great one to go out for, if you were going out for the night, even though I was her, well, when she was a bit older, I guess, you know, her mother or her dad. And she was great fun. She loved the crack. She just, did an almighty lot of giggling for the first 21 years of her life and laughing. And and I had her actually in school. I taught her in school for 4 of the years. And
oh, God help you both.
Well, I think she far surpassed me in music early on, so I used to channel her energies into
vicarious living.
Okay. Into musical exploits and stuff in the school, you know.
So. Oh, I see. Okay, very good. And from France, was it daily contact or weekly or how?
Oh, God, daily. Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. I know that would be nothing new because she wasn't a great fan for going to bed early, but then I'm kind of accused of that a bit myself. So she could be sending you texts at 10, 11 and maybe even 12 o'clock at night, you know. She'd have a lot of funny things going on. We had a sort of a coded conversation that would go on. Mostly text now. I mean, at the weekend we would speak and, yeah, she was just, I used to really enjoy her. You'd be have laugh out loud, really, at some of the deafness she'd be at, you know. She'd be telling you about the little children in France and, you know, telling you. And she was on, she literally knew nobody there going out in that town, not one person. But she wasn't long there when she found her tribe and, you know, met up with French people playing Irish music in the most zany way, really. She just went to stay in an Airbnb and it turned out that they were one of the few people in that town who held a session once a month playing Irish music. It was just mad.
So it was around, that was September 2017, September, October, November, kind of around this very time then, three years ago.
Yeah, exactly the time.
And you would have become aware that something was wrong around the 8th or 9th of November. Would that be right?
Yeah. On the evening of the 8th, which was a Wednesday, she would have had a half day. In France, they have half day on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And that would be the day that she would, you know, try and get to the internet cafe because I believe the internet was poor in her where she was staying. And she was always having trouble with the phone, which, you know, the saga of the phone went on and on. It's funny about that. And I had given her a new phone when she went back. She came home for her graduation on the 24th of October, and this was 2 weeks later exactly. And, she sent me a lovely photograph that evening and, you know, kind of was just saying, where are you and what's this? And there was no reply. And then I didn't get too panicked about it because, you know, I just kind of thought, yeah. So the following, I did send her a good few messages and there was nothing coming back. And I said, oh, she's dropped the phone or something's happened. So then on the following evening, I hadn't yet told my husband the thing, or I didn't kind of want to, you know, flan my husband drives a school bus. And I didn't kind of want him, you know, anxious or worried about anything. So, you know, I was kind of quietly trying to find out what could be. And I didn't really have any contact with anybody in France at that point. And so, you know, into the night I was still sending messages and I eventually managed to make contact with, well, I didn't realise I had, but I had managed to track down the Airbnb people who had the music, Philippe and Nelly, Lelou, in Annonay, and told him, you know, would he just go to the apartment and could he check with her violin gone? Because she literally wouldn't go into the town. She'd bring the violin with her. You'd never know what had happened, you know. Something could happen. There could be a music session somewhere.
Okay.
And her runners. And so he obviously went down to the, and her runners were gone. Her violin was there. And he then went to the police and they went to the school. And yet I didn't know any of this. We were still unaware of it. Saturday morning, that was by Friday evening, we were aware that there was something wrong and that she was missing. This was now the 10th, and we were on our, and we had to report her missing here, of course, in Ireland. And we went, and we were on literally getting on the plane in Dublin when they announced that, you know, that somebody had been found. Yeah.
And that somebody was Emer.
Yeah.
This story is it's really so horrible that I don't want to. I was enjoying our conversation up until now. Do you know what I mean?
I know.
Because I
yeah.
felt that Emer was kind of with us in spirit, and I don't
know. I think she is.
Do
right.
you? Do you really?
Oh, I do. Oh God, yeah. She'd be saying, "Ma'am, do you really have to go into the morbid details?" Like.
Oh Lord.
Yeah, she became a great Corkonian once she went to UCC, and she adored Cork. And she down to the taxi drivers, and she loved mimicking, of course, so she was forever taking off someone. And she had the best fun and the best friends in the orchestra and the students in UCC, but particularly the UCC Orchestra, that family, they just became her closest friends. And she had 3 years or 3 or 4 years of a... She absolutely had a ball down there.
Good. Yeah. She loved it.
She loved it.
If we go back to France for a moment, just to establish what happened to Emer, in so far as you want to tell us, Mary, or as far as you're comfortable telling us.
Okay.
Why don't you have a go and try that, and don't go where you don't want to be.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, she loved to run. She was always, you know, to go jogging or running. That was her kind of a release apart from playing music. And she was on Sunday. She had, you know, been telling me about this beautiful hidden trails that she had found in the woods. And of course, straight away I was going, God, stop, don't be running on your own in the woods. But of course, it wasn't really anything like I had imagined. It was a beautiful just pathway through the trees, and the colours were stunning. And, you know, you had all the maple leaves, tons of them, absolutely dry leaves on the ground. And what they've established was that when she was running, that she possibly tripped on the root of a hidden root, you know, with all the, you know, 18 inches of leaves, and it kind of catapulted her forward, and she went down a ravine into what at that point was a stream, but, you know, when we were there in May or June the following year, when the snows had melted, it was a river, actually, but it was just, you know, it was low water. And there was one rock there, and she hit her head off the rock, and that was the end of, yeah. So it was really Saturday, so from Wednesday to Saturday before we were able to establish, well, to Saturday really before we were told, like, and even at that point, I mean, everybody, including the authorities over there, were thinking the worst, that because she had kind of, she'd gone down under the bank, just under the bank, which was only about, you know, 12 or 13 feet deep, but I presume just because she hit the rock, you know. But initially they thought the worst, and there was a great relief, I think, both in Ireland and in our family and among our friends, that it was accidental and that there was no foul play, you know.
Yeah, it was just a horrible, horrible accident.
It was just the freakiest thing, because, I mean, she would have run in much more, you know, even here where we live, it's beautiful with the hills and everything, and she often came back in the dusk, and I would say, oh, God, Emer, could you try and come home before it's dark, like... But it wouldn't even worry her going off running in that kind of... She was that kind of girl, and she just didn't see danger, and she didn't... she never worried about things in life, and wasn't it a lovely way to live, really?
Well, you've celebrated her life in such a joyful, positive way that you feel that she had, up until this, obviously, this horrible, fatal moment, she had a gorgeous life, thank God.
She had,
you know, that she didn't kind of... Anyway, look, the point I'm trying to make is that you now have this situation on your hands, Mary. You've been a principal for nearly 30 years. You've worked with kids all your life, and you've dealt with, I'm sure, all sorts of tragedies, but from a distance. And now here it's visited upon your own doorstep. How did you all cope with the news as a family?
Oh, my God, it was just devastation. I mean, I don't think, and we lost a beautiful young child, Kira, in our own school, and because it's a small school, and that was a huge tragedy to all of us in the area, as well as her dear family and ourselves. And then, but when Emer died, I don't think I had any real, complete sense of loss. I think my understanding of loss has completely changed. Real loss. I mean, there's loss when you lose your parents. It's the loss of a child is something.
It's the greatest aberration of nature.
It is, really.
For a child to go before a parent, and there's nothing right about it.
No.
At all, and you know, no kind words. There's no salve.
No, word. I mean, people. Absolutely. I mean, the whole country was so amazing. They were so incredibly supportive of us. And still are. But I think we had to try to get to navigate a way through it ourselves, because, I mean, certain things that people say, like, you know, you'll get over, the word over is completely wrong. It should never be used in a situation. If you can try to get through it. I mean, the boys were incredibly strong, and Flynn, my husband, and they, particularly Cahal, her youngest brother, they were extremely close when they were very small kids. And the two older boys adored her, of course, because she was the only girl, and Declan and Michael, they teased the hell out of her, mind you.
Yeah, that's part and parcel of the sibling world.
And she would, her way of dealing with it was so funny. By the time she was 12 or 13, she was well able to play Bohemian Rhapsody. So she would go to the piano.
Wow.
And beat it out.
And beat them that way.
She beat them that way, absolutely.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah. When you wrote to us 3 years ago, do you remember putting pen to paper that time? Or
yeah, I do actually, because I was finding it. I think I was stunned in so many different ways. I mean, I was stunned obviously from the accident, from the loss of this beautiful human being in our lives, but I was incredibly stunned by the community and by the whole extended community here. Who actually lifted us up, and we just kind of, it was like being on a, you know, I won't say a cloud, that's the wrong word, a kind of a wave that just, they carried us along through the depths of terrible despair, really, and huge numbers of people helped us, and I will never forget that, and it just brought to mind to me, you know, that community is massively important, and I suppose, you know, what we might talk about in a few minutes is a different community, but that, you know, that community is probably key, really, because, you know, yeah, key. I think that community, without community, we don't really have anything.
We have nothing,
And when the music died, as it did for us, like in our lives at that time, I think if it hadn't been, I think the light started to shine really through a different community, as well as through the community that I spoke about at the time, you know, and I think we can't underestimate how valuable it is to us, even at this time, going through this very strange 2020 year, you know.
Yeah, because you couldn't speak the last time because it was too soon.
It was too hard.
Yeah,
it was
too hard.
I couldn't speak for about 18 months about, literally, nearly 20 months.
Well, what did you do with all that emotion, that 18 months of pent-up emotion? Where did it go?
Well, I wrote stuff, and I also walked an awful lot. I walked and walked the burn, and I walked up here over the beautiful walks all around Loch Rainy and Flegg Mountain, Carr here. And I kind of immersed myself in nature, and I just watched all the changing and then going, you know, as we are now going into the dying of the season. And then you see the resurrection again in spring of the beautiful countryside. I think nature was an incredible salve for me. I read a lot of books. And we talked a lot, really, ourselves, Lan and myself and the lads, you know. And we tried to keep talking, even though it was hard-like. And then I had amazing, wonderful, we call them the angels here beside us, Tina and Kathleen and Mary and Margaret, you know, and Nora and Roger. Those people kept us, and all my family, of course. I couldn't forget them. They were just unbelievable.
I mentioned a young man who passed away this summer, yesterday morning on the programme, and I see his friends. And at 21, there you can see how the sadness, and it's quite a lot to process at such a young age.
I even with her friends like that, you know, and even through their devastation, they keep in contact with us all the time, and they text us, and I text them, and I really sort of feel like she's alive with them and still on the journey with them.
And is that important for you? Because I think a lot of parents of younger people who've passed away too soon will want to know what is the best way to stay sane and to stay afloat?
Well, I suppose, you know, well, I would say one of the things that was a great help to us was that constant, you know, keeping in contact and embracing her friends, because you also know that they are massively hurting. And, you know, I suppose you kind of have to reach out, even though you're so locked into your own sadness, really. And I think you have to try desperately to remember all of the things that they would want you to be doing, and they wouldn't want us to be desperately sad, and they wouldn't want us to be down or, you know, morose. And I know she would say, you know, ma'am, come on.
I get the impression, Mary, that you speak to Emer a lot, and that involves a lot of Emer saying to you, get your act together, get down to the shops, stop moaning, and just keep going.
Absolutely. absolutely. I talk to her all the time.
I can hear her talking to you almost. You wrote to us, you said, when we returned to Ireland a week later after the horrible events that we talked about, that you said that we were completely stunned by the unbelievable community spirit that saw us cope through the early days of this tragedy. Like so many others who've suffered the loss of a child, our lives have changed irrevocably. And you talked about the flight attendant who held our hands and hearts after hearing the news, the inhabitants of the tiny town of Annonay, the incredible attaché to the Irish Embassy in Paris, Mick Moran, who stayed with and supported us in France through those initial days of shock and crippling grief. And you've mentioned your friends and neighbours around the place. All these kindnesses, these micro kindnesses that lead to a macro greatness and goodness, brings us to the Emer Noonan Music Bursary Award established 2 years ago to help young people in the west of Ireland to get access to music. This is a beautiful legacy, Mary, if I may say so.
Yeah, thank you, Ryan. It is actually, because now we can see the music carrying on. So the music hasn't died. That's the whole thing. The music hasn't died. And Katharina Baker, who is the leader of and the director of Cool Music, and her very able assistant, Fiona Buckley, came to us in the spring, around the time of her birthday in 2018. And, you know, we were planting a tree in her honour and remembrance of her. And we've done a lot of planting gardens, actually. There's gardens for Emer everywhere around the place here. And Katharina had written this magnificent piece of orchestral music called Carpe Diem, and they wanted to perform it in her memory. So a concert was organised for her actual anniversary in November 2018. And it was probably one of the most magical nights I was ever at anything. And it was full of, I mean, there was a whole seesaw of emotions at it, but it was wonderfully cathartic for us, even if it involved tears and everything. You know, it was very uplifting, and all her friends came, and as I say, the Cool Music orchestras and her friends who played, the youngsters who played music, and it was the most magical night. She was right there, having a right good time in the middle of it. So they did it again in 2019, mm-hmm. and this year we remembered another beautiful young man from the same area down near Gort, Eli Murray, who also died tragically and was a musician and singer, great young fella. And so from those two concerts, the proceeds have gone mostly towards the bursary, which we formed, and we've got an incredible amount of private donations as well, very great generosity. So this year, of course, there's no concert.
Yeah.
So once again, you know, it was actually my son this time, Michael, who lives in London, came up with the idea of doing an online musical challenge.
Great.
And he said, "Don't you remember Emer and all the screaming with the ice bucket challenge?" And I was going, what are you thinking about doing now? And he said, "Well, Mary, this will be like the ice bucket challenge, but there won't be any freezing water or screaming." So, and really, the idea was born, and we have a fantastic, we call it the Carpe Diem event, of course, from Seize the Day, because that's the kind of character they really felt, that was the kind of character she was, and she just went for it. And so the Carpe Diem event this year is online. And we have the most phenomenal response from singers and musicians all over the country. These are all the well-known household names. In fact, our own neighbour and great friend of the family, Martin Hayes, is going to, that he's going to start off the proceedings next Sunday. And then it goes on for 2 weeks, so I think we should have a national holiday, really.
It sounds like it's going to be a rolling festival.
Early winter festival.
Why not?
Forget sound and all that carry on. Let's have a music festival, you know.
It sounds gore. And how do people get involved then?
What they do basically is that they, you know, film a short performance, something hopefully happy and joyful, and they upload it to their own social media page. And then there's a media page that we've created called Carpe Diem Sing and Play. So the event itself is called Seize the Day, Sing and Play, Remembering Emer. So they can just, they upload it, and there's people waving things at me here telling me to say, "Don't forget to say it.
Don't forget to say it.
Don't forget to put in the hashtag Carpe diem, sing and play. I have no real idea why you have to put in a hashtag, but I'm sure there's a good reason why.
Mary, people like us don't have to ask the reason why. We just have to do these things and presume that we're being well advised. How about that?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
It's been good to talk to you. It's been very good to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Thank you. Thank you so much. I really want to say a big thank you to the Carpe Diem committee.
Of course.
And I'm talking about Fiona and Ellie and Paula and my own son Michael in London.
Yeah.
And Emma, Declan's girlfriend, and Tommy, who's a fantastic puppeteer, your man's puppets.
Don't forget Tommy now with the puppets. I mean, the whole thing would fall apart if he wasn't there pulling the string. But listen, to you and Declan and Michael, Cottle, and obviously Flan, we're sending you all our love. I really mean that. And it's so nice to put a voice to the letter. And I hope
much.
We can be friends.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Thank you. I really appreciate it. And we got a huge feedback, actually, from the letter. Thank you.
I'm glad to hear it. Well, look, it's so lovely. And I'll raise my cup to Emer here this morning, if that's okay with you.
So I hope lots of people, and everyone and anyone can join the Carpe Diem event. And I think actually Eilish is going to put it on your...
We sure are. Our Facebook page and all our details. We'll put everything up there so that people can come straight to us and get what they need.
Brilliant.
Mary, have a lovely morning. That wasn't easy for you today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Really good to talk to you.
Thank you, Ryan.
Bye for now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It's 8 minutes to 10 this Wednesday even morning. A lot of response to Mary there, listening to Mary talk about losing Emer. I'm floored by her strength. Such an affecting description of her relationship with her daughter. An amazing, articulate lady has put into words exactly how we feel after losing a loved one in our immediate family. I lost my 18-year-old beautiful Louise Duke Keegan in 2017. God help us. That's from Suzanne in Dublin. It's a very hard life to lead, and I feel everything that Mary is saying. And do you know what I like what you did there, Suzanne? Is you told us Louise's name. I think it's important. You can say lose a loved one and keep it anonymous, but I think sometimes it's lovely to bring the person's name out and alive and into the room for that moment. So we'll think about Louise this morning, and thank you for that. And Sinead in Galway says, Mary sounds like the most beautiful person. Emer was obviously just like her, and sadly their time was cut so tragically short. But Emer lives on in Mary's spirit, an amazing person, and I wish her goodness and peace. And that's some lovely messages coming in for Mary Noonan this morning. Thank you for all of that. I'll take a quick break. 9:29 this Thursday morning. Stephen Fry, good morning.
Good morning to you, Ryan. Hello.
It's nice to talk to you again. And here we are back in the classics, the world of the classics. I think it's a world, I could see you in a toga with laurel leaves around your head. Not imperious, but certainly a part and parcel of a knitting group maybe with Cicero.
Well, a lot of classicists, of course, would say, you know, you have to make a choice with classics. Are you a Latinist or are you a Hellenist? Does your heart belong to Greece or to Rome? And you've obviously painted me in a Roman toga and Roman laurels, you see.
Yeah, I shouldn't have done that, of course. Go on.
But I have to say, my heart is always... I remember as a boy when I used to love knowing the Roman names for the Greek gods, but I always used the Greek names. I always thought she was Athena, not Minerva, you know. Mm-hmm. In fact, all the gods have different names except Apollo, who's the same in both.
And that's it. Isn't it childhood lends itself to these stories initially, and then they're so strong and they're so exciting that they just travel with you to the grave, essentially.
You're so right. Absolutely. They certainly have with me. There's something about them that just sticks in the mind, and the characters and the personalities in them grow as you grow. So, you know, you think of them in a certain way when you're young with a certain kind of dash and excitement, and then they become enriched and more fascinating the older you get. So a character like Achilles, who's a golden, glorious character when you're young, there's, you know, the tragedy of him and the impulsive stupidity of him, the rashness, the temper, all those qualities, you realize are so much a part of who he is and so much a part of who we are. I mean, the great thing about these myths is that they understand what it is to be human, I think, so completely.
Yeah, I mean, even you say Achilles, and we'll say, all right, Achilles' heel. And you say, well, actually, it comes from there was a warrior once upon a time. Or you talk about going on an odyssey. And that comes from our friend Odysseus. I mean, the language. You're a language guy. I just think the language, whether it's from our friends in Greece or Rome, has travelled again so profoundly that it's almost like a detective game when you're reading books sometimes to try and find the etymology of it or whatever.
Absolutely right. You can look back, and so much of our language and our discourse and the way we think about things does originate from Greece and Rome, and is there in the language, as you rightly say. I mean, even in the story of Troy and its aftermath, there's a character called there's a mentor, for example. That's where we get the word mentor. There's a stentor, for that matter, who's got a very loud voice, and stentorian voices. You know, I mean, there's so many of these. You think, oh, that's where that's from. Good heavens. And also, I love the fact that because the Trojan War is a kind of later part of Greek myth, when it's no longer semi-divine heroes, you know, who have gods for fathers. They're pretty human. All the participants are human beings, but the gods do still get involved in it. And you can make up your mind as to how much the gods really do. I'm sure you, like me, sometimes might say, oh, the muse wasn't with me that day. We don't really believe there's a muse sitting on one's shoulder talking into one's ear. And similarly, the Greeks, if they were, you know, in a battle and one of them drew back a bow and pulled off a really good shot, they would say, thank you, Apollo, because Apollo was the god of archery, you know. So it's hard to say when the gods involve themselves in human affairs, whether it's a metaphor, whether really you're just using the god in the same way as Basil Fawlty shaking his fist at the roof, saying, thank you, God. whether they are genuinely involved. That's what I love about it. It's that mixture of the fantastic and the real.
I was laughing because I often say, well, the chat show gods were smiling on me last Friday night when something good happened. You know, I just think, and then my colleagues will say, no, we worked hard to make that happen. I said, no, I know that, but there was an element of the Olympian involvement, you know.
It's impossible to avoid thinking like that somehow. I rather like it. I think it's a good thing, even if one doesn't, as you say, actually believe that there are chat show gods. And if there are, I wonder who, well, I guess in your case, Terry Wogan would have ascended to it, you know, in the Irish chat show gods and the wonderful Gay Byrne,
of course. Of course. They're up there definitely on whatever Olympian mountain for the former hosts go to. Good crack, though, I'd say. Let me ask you about the physicality of visiting a country like our city, whether it's Athens or Rome or wherever it might be. And it's kind of all history. If you love history as much as I suspect you do, and I would, and most of our listeners would, when you go to a place, whether it's famine Ireland or whether it's Tudor Britain, England, or whether it's ancient Greece, do you ever kind of wish you could just close your eyes and be there for 3 minutes?
Yeah, and indeed, you kind of do. I mean, it's impossible. For example, in Greece, Delphi is a wonderful place to visit because there's so much there. That was the location of the famous oracle where Greeks throughout myth and indeed through real historical Greece would go to Delphi, and there would be a priestess called a Pitha who would interpret the words of Apollo, and they were always slightly ambiguous, you know, so you never quite knew what the future held. And there was a kind of gas, that a sort of sulfurous gas that came up and is, you know, part of the geology of that area, which of course they thought was Gaia, the earth goddess, sending up messages. But if you go there now, you can feel and see and touch these stones and these, you know, it's a ruin, but it's a very well-preserved ruin. And there's even above one area you can walk up, there's a running track, what the Greeks called a stadion, from which we get stadium, of course. Stadium was a length, and you almost don't even have to close your eyes. You just half close them, and you think you can hear the cheer of Greeks, and you can see a queue of Greek people worriedly lining up, waiting for the oracle to pronounce on their destiny. Mm. It's fantastic to be that in touch. Another place is Epidaurus, or is the Greek. It now Epidavros, which is the famous theatre. But there's also There's also an Asclepion. There was a Greek healer called Asclepius, who actually became divine and became the god of medicine. And these Asclepions were basically exactly like hotel spas today. There would be baths, there would be white-coated or white-shifted priests and people who would massage you, interpret your dreams, clean your guts out with various purgatives and so on. And it was just like it was, and actually you can go to it and you can see this graffiti and you can see, you know, little bits that the healers, you know, the staff had carved in for people's treatments. I mean, it's just incredibly close. You know, that's what's so wonderful.
That's it.
How close our ancestors are.
Yeah, cave et emptor, cave canum. You know, these.
Yes,
I'm going Roman again because that's my. I'm leaning there.
Yes.
We're covering the whole panoply here of the ancients. So that's. But back to Troy. I presume you see in Troy and in most history, particularly the epic stories, you see a salutary, I don't know if warning is the right word, but certainly a salutary tale.
Yes, I think what's wonderful about it is that although it's the Trojan War and it's the siege of a city, well, every element of it is so profoundly human and is to do with our weaknesses and faults, our vanities, our rage, our love, betrayal, all those things are what animates the story and makes it last as long as it has lasted. And, you know, to be reintroduced to it as I was a year or so ago when I started re-researching and going into it, I was just staggered by how close to our life it is. I mean, there's a horrible fact is that the Iliad, which is Homer's famous epic poem, which is about a short period towards the end of the Trojan War, the incredibly important period. And it starts with a plague. It starts with a disease sweeping through the Greek camp and the horror that it brings. And amazingly, the way Homer describes it, it starts with the animals.
Right. Oh, my
and
gosh.
It,
yeah,
it goes
yeah.
from the animals to the humans.
Yeah.
Zoonotic, as we call it grandly these days. Mm. And all that talk about bats and pangolins and things in China. As soon as I saw that that news, I was reminded of the Trojan War, of how and was it an insight that Homer had or, you know, Homer's people, that when you had a plague, it often started with the animals? I mean, the way he describes it, Apollo storms down from Olympus with and fires plague arrows into the Greek camp, and they hit the animals first, and the animals become sick, and then the humans get it. But it gave me real pause when I saw that. I thought, heavens.
And also, I often find the story of Cassandra fascinating, whether it's about the economy and somebody going, you're all spending too much, that there's going to be a property bubble, or equally with this thing going, we're going to have to lock down, and they're not believed until.
Yes.
Until
poor Cassandra.
It's too late, and then everyone goes, Cassandra told us. There was no one listened to the poor woman.
Yes, that's right. She was cursed by Apollo, as you rightly say, to be a he'd given her the gift of prophecy. Because she was a priestess in his table. She was a royal princess of Troy, in fact. She was
right,
a daughter of Hecuba and Priam, and so a sister of Hector and Paris and the others. And she was worked in the temple, as it were, of Apollo, and he gave her the gift of prophecy, and he then moved in to take his reward, as it were.
Yes.
And she said, no, absolutely not. I'm not going to. I refuse.
This wasn't transactional.
Yeah, and he was so furious. He couldn't take away the gift of prophecy because gods can't take away gifts they give you, but he could amend it. So he spat into her open mouth as she was saying the word no. And that spit was the curse that although she had this perfect gift of prophecy, no one would ever believe it.
Gosh.
And of course, it is true, isn't it, that when you prophesy, if you are correct, people retrospectively don't believe you. So, for example, if, let us suppose, the lockdown had worked perfectly, and those who predicted that the disease would go really, really badly unless there was a lockdown, you have the lockdown, then everything is solved. People would say, see, there was no problem. There was no need for that lockdown.
Yeah.
You say, well, no, because you predict something, you can alter the the course of the future, if you see what I mean.
Yes, of course.
But of course, that hasn't been the case with us, has it? You know, let's not go down that.
Well, it is. You know, I was just talking a little bit earlier on before we got had our conversation about what you might call lockdown loneliness.
It's
a pandemic in itself.
It is. I think it's very important, Ryan, though, to remember that obviously that everyone is different and people respond in different ways. And a lot of people are pressured into thinking that they should respond to this lockdown in a certain way, that, you know, they should learn Russian and bake soda bread every day and all that sort of thing. And if they don't, they feel inadequate. And they see so many examples of people who, you know, knitted a carpet and so on. And they feel like, oh, I've failed. But there is no right way to deal with it. And similarly, not everybody dislikes being excluded from the social world. Some people who are anxious at parties and in the public sphere, and maybe have a touch of agoraphobia and a fear of going outside. That for them, that's a kind of, they're almost embarrassed to admit that if it came to a choice between enforced socialization and enforced seclusion, they would choose enforced seclusion any day.
Yeah, for sure.
And there are plenty of us who feel a bit like that.
Well,
and then we feel a bit like we miss it. You know, the point is there's such a range of responses that we can all have that for anyone to say, this is how we all feel, I think is, it's a bit like when people say we're all in the same boat, I want to shout. No, we're not. We may all be on the same sea, the same rough seas, but we've all got very different boats. Some of us are lucky enough to have fully weatherproof, beautiful. Others are in super yachts and, you know, cruisers. And some people are in very leaky vessels indeed. And they don't like hearing that everyone's in the same boat, because that's obviously not true. But also everyone's got their own way of coping or not coping and their own fear and anxiety. But you're certainly right that there's a great deal of pressure on our minds and our stability and our inner strength. And it's very easy to lose it. But I think the most important thing is to remember that it's however one feels is okay. There is no right way to respond to this. There is no approved way that healthy people respond to it, as opposed to a bad way that unhealthy people, because we're all in this kind of learning position. We don't know how we're going to feel in a week's time, let alone how we feel now. We don't know whether we'll make it to Christmas without breaking down, or we don't know, you know, or we might actually think, oh, thank goodness, I love this. I love just being alone at home or with one or two people of my family or whatever, and don't let it stop, you know, and then they'll feel guilty for feeling that.
There's also the need to I suppose, take away a sense of shame if you're feeling emotionally, mentally fragile.
Oh, absolutely. That's the last thing to feel ashamed about. I mean, I think, you know, for most of us are going to have periods of that. Periods of real fragility and instability and wobble. And I, you know, it's so important that we all support each other in that regard. And if you haven't already, you know, why not write an email or a message or a, you know, WhatsApp or whatever it is you do to your family group and say, just to remind us that if any of us suddenly feel a bit, you know, down and really worried and so on, we're there for each other, you know. That's so important.
My 21-year-old oldest daughter said to me one day, "You're just not feeling it today, are you?" I thought, what a great expression.
That's good.
It's good, isn't it? Just not feeling it today, are you? Because she kind of saw it in my head, or when I was frowning or something like that, and I just thought, that's insightful.
Yeah, that's a good phrase. It's a lot better than that, the one that's driving me crazy at the moment, which is, "You got this." Don't tell me. What have I got?
Stephen, it's driving me mad. Like things like, they reached out to my people. You know, they
reached out,
or to your point, or we're going to drill down on this now, or we're going to unpack that.
Drill down to the granular detail.
That's it. Are we going to unpack this argument piece by piece? You're going, well, what happened to language? It was fine. It wasn't broken. Stop fixing it.
It's weird, isn't it? I don't want to get so... I mean, I try not to be a language snob.
Yes.
I mean, I don't mind people using language in unusual ways or, you know, splitting infinitives or whatever. But it's just the endless batting and forward of clichés. And people describe me as, oh, you're dropping your new book, are you?
Oh, yeah, dropping a new book. That's because they're dropping a new series on Netflix. And then you get pushback. You're getting pushback?
I think it's important to laugh at it rather than be cross.
Oh, listen, laugh at it, and then when they come in to feast on your innards, to ignore them because we're just trying to have a laugh.
I said to a friend who works in radio like you, I said, see if you can say to your interviewees that you will cut them short and not mention their book or their film or whatever it is if they start a sentence with the word so.
Oh, very good. Well, that's an interview over. We wouldn't have a radio show.
You really wouldn't, would you?
No, not at all. We'd all be taken off. So, Stephen, it's been great to have you on the... But you said a beautiful thing once about mood, which I loved, which was that mood is the equivalent of the weather.
Yes.
I love that.
Yes, I think that's right. I think a lot of people, when their mood is really, really down, or indeed really, really up, they either blame themselves or they try and deny it. And in fact, it is like the weather. The weather is real. When it's raining, it really is raining. You can't pretend it isn't. Yes. You can't think the water away. But nor is it your fault. You haven't caused that rain. It's something that that just, you know, will happen from time to time. And the fact that it's raining doesn't mean that it might not be sunny tomorrow. So it's those three things that are so important to remember, that the mood, you know, a down mood is not your fault. It's something that happens from, you know, outside your will or your moral center. It's not something to be blamed for. It's like the weather in that sense. Also, it is real. It's no good denying it and saying, I'm imagining it. Because if it's real, it's real. And just, you know, understand and live with it. But also don't feel, oh, that's it then. Now I'm down. That's forever. Because the clouds will roll away. And so some form of, you know, mental umbrella if you can. But the most important thing is not to blame yourself or feel that it's permanent, I guess. Yeah. So that's certainly the way I try and convince myself.
Because you said at one point, I don't like my own company very much, which is odd given how many times people very kindly tell me that they put me on their ideal dinner party guest list. So it's ghastly. If you take that to its natural conclusion, if you were invited to that ideal dinner party, you'd hate to sit beside yourself.
It is a bit mad, isn't it? But I think, you know, we're all like that a bit. We kind of, it's quite good when you realise sometimes, what is it I'm feeling now? Oh, I know what it is. I'm annoying myself.
Yes.
We know when friends and even loved ones can annoy one. It's bound to be able to, it's bound to be true that there will be times when you get needled and bit and peed off by your friends. But you can also get a bit annoyed by your own company and think, oh, shut up, Stephen. Stop talking to yourself like that. Just, you know, I want to ignore myself for a while.
I know. How do you do that?
It's not easy. No. It has to be said.
It's not easy. But I think that even... part of it is escape, and escape I found in the last number of months is in weirdly crime fiction.
That's interesting. I'm just about to start. I've got it's sort of next down on my pile. John Banville's Snow.
Now, Stephen, I've been banging on about it for the last 2 weeks. I can't believe you picked that one. About it. Yeah, it's delicious and dark.
Because I like his crime writing. He writes
great. Benjamin Black.
Exactly, as Benjamin Black, but this, he's combining his kind of literary chops, and few writers alive in English have greater literary chops than John Banville. I've loved his previous books, and with his fabulous ability to tell a great crime story, so I just can't wait to read it.
I'd be shocked if you'd be disappointed now, and I hope I'm not doing a Cassandra on it, but I think you'll be okay.
Yeah. Also, there's a new. There's a new Jack Reacher, and I have to say I'm a sucker for Jack Reacher.
We need stuff like that, though.
People are very shocked when I say that, because he's kind of like so manly and military and kind of, you know, he's like he's carved out of rock in some ways. But he comes out of the same stable as Clint Eastwood's Man With No Name or John Wayne characters or Gary Cooper characters. There's something... it is so different from me. You know, I'm a fluffy, silly, sentimental old fool. And even in the way I use language, I ornate and so on, whereas Lee Child uses language like Hemingway, stripped down, yeah. You know, very few descriptive words. And yet, I think that's probably why I like it, in the same way that opposites attract. So.
Can I ask you, I have to go now, but can I ask you, can we do this a chat maybe between now and Christmas and talk books or something like that for
Wouldn't
the crack?
That be fun?
I'd
Absolutely.
Love to do that, because we're singing the same song then, and maybe you'll give us a song or two that you like. We'll play a track for you coming up to Christmas. And if you're free to do it, now you don't have to say
that's
yes now. On air, that'll catch you on the huff, but it would be great. I'd love that.
I was due to be in Dublin herself, so I was, were it not for this nonsense. So okay. This will make up for it.
I'd love that. Listen, congratulations on Troy. It completes a beautiful trilogy that would make a very comfortable addition to any bookshelf in people's houses around the country. And let's do this again sometime soon, Stephen. Massive response to you on the text, by the way. You are beloved, so please take that in your sails as you head wherever you're going next. Thank you, Stephen Fry.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Nice to talk to you. Good night indeed. Must have had to put in a late night. But loads of text. 51551. I could listen to Stephen all day, says Molly. I love the way he describes the way we're dealing with the lockdown. And my boat is very rocky at the moment. Well, sail safely, Molly. And as Stephen says, we're all on that sea. Please tell up, Stephen, that the fabulous Jeeves in Worcester has been one of our COVID escapes. I recommend it all, of course. And Marion O'Dwyer says, will you ask Stephen, is he bringing out a book of his ties? He did it, the Fry Ties, which was him posting pictures on Instagram throughout the lockdown. So we'll talk about that. I might try and get him on again, because I mean, he's just eminently enjoyable to speak to. I can tell you that, and hopefully to listen to. All right. Gosh, you're busy on the text, 51551, but I want to go to our friend, historian Donal Fallon. Good morning, Donal.
Hi, Orion. How are you?
Happy Halloween. I mean, we don't really say that, but I'll say it anyway.
I think we're about to have the first discussion of Dracula and Halloween that was ever preceded by Pharrell Williams' Happy, but it was great.
Well,
I really enjoyed it.
We consider ourselves the practitioners of the art of light and shade.
Absolutely.
And that brings us neatly to you've been hanging out in graveyards, which to me makes you a bit weird, but also makes you very charming and interesting.
Isn't it the weekend for it, though?
Isn't it, though? Yeah? Come on, talk to me. What have you been up to?
You know, I think on one level, when we think about Halloween, as you say, it's synonymous with, you know, American popular culture. So, you know, candy, bobbing for apples, outlandishly decorated house. Now, there seems to be a lot of that going on here this year, which I really like. Mm. I think people are trying to lift the mood. But, you know, the origins of Halloween, I would say, are very much rooted in, you know, the Irish past. And this weekend, we have a festival honouring Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula, of course, born in Dublin, shaped by Sligo, and the man who maybe more than anyone has shaped our kind of image of ghosts and ghouls and Halloween. So I suppose that's what we're talking about this morning. And I would say, you know, to my mind, I think more than any other Irish writer, he had an enormous impact on popular culture. I can hear listeners shouting at the radio, what about James Joyce? Mm. What about Ulysses? Mm. They might be more critically acclaimed, but when it comes to pop culture, you know, Dracula is unmatched. It's been parodied from The Muppets to Carry On. It's been bootlegged by Nosferatu. And, you know, it's in everyone's driveway across the United States this weekend with Halloween.
So why Mount Jerome Cemetery then?
For me, I mean, Mount Jerome Cemetery, just up the road from where I am, is the great kind of Victorian Gothic cemetery of Dublin. It's where Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu, who paved the way for Stoker, is buried. Beautiful headstone. The invisible prince, writer of ghost stories, Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu, buried here. It's where Bram Stoker's mother, who really shaped him, and to me, she is one of the building blocks of Dracula, where she is buried. And crucially, as our listeners should be following the rules, it's within my 5km. It's just down the street. So for me, in lockdown two, and in lockdown one earlier, that really was the place that got me thinking about this time of year.
As you say, the impact of Dracula on popular culture was absolutely a knockout. But much like It's a Wonderful Life, I just shoehorned that reference in there for no reason. It was one of those remarkable classic evergreens, if you want to call it that. Got a mixed review on release.
It was kind of panned when it came out, which is surprising. And I think people didn't like it because they thought it was a bit too modern, the way he was writing, you know, the train journeys, the diaries, all of that. The Spectator in England gave it a really bad review, like just a shockingly bad review. They said, Mr. Stoker has shown considerable ability in the use that he has made of all available traditions of vampirology. There's a great word, vampirology. But we think his story would have been all the more effective if he'd chosen an earlier period. But, you know, I think, you know, never judge a book by its cover. That's a familiar one for everyone. But also never judge a book by its movie. You know, don't judge Dracula by the pop culture that it spawned later on. I think go back and read the book itself. And you get a real sense from that book. Stoker was a man who worked in the theatre for many years. I think he wrote Dracula, envisioning a future life for it, if you will, off the page. Mm. But the fact that it's so modern to me is one of the things that makes it so enduring. No one can name the earlier Irish vampire tales. You know, Lefanu wrote Carmilla 25 years before Dracula. Mm. It's faded into total obscurity. There's a reason, I think, that Dracula, quite fittingly, has kind of refused to die.
Mm. Yeah, of course, indeed. Yeah. And but all the neck biting and the teeth, and you know, it was kind of edgy, wasn't it? Veering in towards the erotic.
Very much so. Yeah, I mean, Carmilla by Lefanu was about a lesbian vampire, so it was barely out there too, 25 years before Dracula. Mm. But definitely, Dracula ticked all the boxes. You know, the fear of illness. Dracula himself, of course, is this kind of unusual, exotic immigrant foreigner. They talk about how, you know, Stoker may have been even shaped by the contemporary discourse in Ireland at that time. He was very much a home ruler. Parnell was being presented in the British press as a vampire, you know, on the front of Punch magazine, absentee landlords, big houses, all of that was going on here. Mm. So within that book, there's a lot of the contemporary world. You know, Stoker, I think, was very, very shaped by this place. And I think you can find Ireland without digging too hard in the pages of Dracula.
And why do we bother with a bonfire on Halloween?
Yeah, in the broader sense, I mean, Halloween to me is deeply, deeply rooted in Irish folklore. It's rooted in Samhain, that great festival described brilliantly in one 10th century text as when the summer went to rest. And, you know, as far as the Celts were concerned, Samhain was the beginning of the new year. It was a weird kind of between time, you might say, when mortals could kind of visit the world of the dead and vice versa. And some of their things made it true into Christian Ireland. So the bonfires, they thought, had kind of protective and cleansing powers. And that's probably one custom that, you know, some people, I'm thinking particularly of Dublin Fire Brigade, would like to see vanish. But another lingering thing from Samhain was this great tradition they called mumming.
Yeah.
And mumming basically was going house to house, dressed in costume. The Americans have bestowed the name trick or treat on that one. But, you know, the name Halloween definitely comes from Hallow's Eve and Christian things that came later. But the ritual, you know, to me, the ritual of the bonfire, of the trick or treating, of the pumpkin, all of that, I think, has its origins in the earlier pagan festival of Samhain. And it's kind of funny how much pagan stuff, how much pagan ritual survived in Ireland. I mean, they say that the snakes Patrick chased from Ireland, because, you know our climate, God help any snakes here, but they're a metaphor for paganism. But I don't know how well Patrick did driving paganism out of Ireland, considering we're still celebrating Samhain.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the paraphrasing, like, pagans have more fun.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a little darkness there, isn't there? You know, it's a little less of the Catholic guilt, Donald, you know.
Yeah. But I don't think it's coincidental that when you look at the Americans really go all out on Halloween. I mean, I think it's something we can claim, not only that Halloween has its origins in Ireland, but that the widespread celebration of the day in America owes something to European migration. I mean, the Irish and the Scottish loved Samhain. And look where they celebrated in the States, especially strong on the East Coast, where those people settled. So much of American popular culture is shaped by her immigrant history, her Germans, her Poles, her Scottish, and of course, her Irish migrants. But the Americans have turned it into something just totally different, you know, from what it was here.
Yes.
And it's amazing how far back that even goes. I mean, the mass-produced Halloween costumes in America have been a feature of life since the 1930s.
Yeah, amazing.
Ben Cooper, I remember wearing a black bin bag to school in the 1990s, as I'm sure many listeners did too.
Yes.
The Americans have had a crass commercial Halloween since the days of the Great Depression. Isn't that in itself absolutely remarkable? And Dracula has always been one of those, you know, pop culture American costumes.
What figure in history, in any period of any time, from any part of the world, would you like to dress up as tomorrow night, Donal?
I'm not going to say a plague doctor. I think I've seen a few people in America going as plague doctors this year. I think we should keep the past and the present very much separate.
So who are you going to go for?
I always enjoyed Halloween in school. I went to a Gael school and we always got into the historical figures and the like. I think I did Brian Boru on one occasion, and there were a couple of Vikings in the class as well. But I like when people draw on legend and history
definitely,
on Halloween.
Definitely. Because I have Alexander Hamilton in my car a lot due to influences from children at the moment. Young women, but anyway, I'm thinking Alexander Hamilton. I mean, what the hell has it come to? It's part of the ongoing COVID madness, as you well know.
But just don't let the character take over. You know, I'm thinking of poor Bela Lugosi, the classic the classic big screen Dracula, who was actually buried in his Dracula cape. You know, he
took it
Dracula
too far.
In his own mind. They didn't put the stake to the heart, but everything else for poor old Bela Lugosi.
Donal, it's always good to talk to you. And I know that your Three Castles Burning podcast is flying, and you're doing a special for the Bram Stoker Festival for people who can walk around. What a lovely idea, walk around.
It's really nice, you know, that we can take a festival that normally you have to come to Dublin to partake in. This year, like the Bram Stoker Festival, it's not even national, it's international. You can tune into it from anywhere in the world. And I think that's really, really nice that, you know, I don't think even Bram Stoker could imagine the terror of Zoom table quizzes. But let us use technology for good.
That is
do
for
get
sure.
involved.
That is for sure. Great to talk to you, Donal. Mind yourself.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you kindly. Donal Fallon joining us on the programme there. BramStokerFestival.com if you're interested in that, or rte.ie/culture. That's another place to go. But I have to say, the interpretation of Bram Stoker, the man that I loved so much, is, and I'll say it again, is Joseph O'Connor's Shadow Play. And the good news for listeners is that it is going to be the Irish, the Book on One here on RT, read by Joe himself, which is pretty lovely. And details of that are online as well, rte.ie. You'll find it there. But that'll be a lovely way to spend some time next week.